Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Next Wednesday night, I'll be hosting a night with WNYC at the Paley Center in Midtown Manhattan. And I hope you'll come and be there. This will include lots of WNYC hosts, the funny and incisive Kurt Anderson from Studio 360, the incomparable Brooke Gladstone from On the Media, and our newest colleagues, John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from our upcoming new morning show, The Takeaway. We'll talk about trends in the media today, on air and online, old media, new media, public media, and it should really be fun. So come on and join us. This will be 6:30 Wednesday night at the Paley Center, formerly known as the Museum of Television and Radio, at 25 West 52nd Street near 6th Avenue. For discount tickets or more information, see the events page at WNYC.org. Just click on events. Well, John McCain isn't the only one with foreclosures on his mind. A few communities in New York are especially struggling with the crisis, communities including Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn and Williamsbridge in the South Bronx. With us now, Dwayne Jones, Director of Lending at the Porodnik Foundation, a nonprofit that does foreclosure intervention in the city, and Eileen Markey, freelance reporter who has written on foreclosure for the Village Voice and the National Catholic Reporter. Eileen, Dwayne, thanks for coming on WNYC today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dwayne Jones, talk about your agency. What do you do? Who are you helping?
Well, the primary thing that we're doing in collaboration with other community-based organizations is getting preventive education, financial and loan counseling, and then just direct loan and legal remediation, basically, with the homeowner negotiating with the banks and with the legal aid services, identifying predatory issues that assist in negotiations with the banks or proceed on to just litigation.
And I want to open up the phones on this segment for anyone who has recently gone through foreclosure, anyone who is currently trying to stave off foreclosure, or anyone else perhaps who is working with people trying to stave off foreclosure in our area. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's all get together here and talk about the state of the foreclosure crisis in and around New York City. 212-433-9692. Tell us your story. If you're on the brink of foreclosure yourself or think you might soon be, what do you need? Call and you can ask our guests for help even. 212-433-WNYC. Demographically, Dwayne, who's getting hit the hardest and what neighborhoods are they from?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's nationwide. When you talk about where is it the most intense, it's in communities of color. Generally, the economic stature of it isn't as relevant as the fact that it's a community of color. The thing that's most relevant is just the intensity of the efforts to target those communities products that just aren't appropriate for homeowners to survive as homeowners.
So where
in that area,
Bed-Stuy, Williamsbridge, we know those two. Are those the epicenters?
Right, South Jamaica, Queens,
Rockaway in Queens.
Right, parts of Staten Island. I mean, you can.
So Eileen, talk about Williamsbridge because I know you wrote it up in the National Catholic Reporter recently.
Right, and in the Voice.
In the Voice.
Williamsbridge is a neighborhood actually in the North Bronx, or the Central Bronx. It's north of the Cross Bronx Expressway and up by just kind of south of Yonkers. But it's a working-class neighborhood, mainly of Caribbean immigrants. There's a lot of Jamaican and Barbadians and West Africans. There's a lot of people from Ghana and Nigeria. It's a neighborhood of brick houses, and when I was there, I was just thinking of that old song, you know, Little Brick Houses for Everyone. It's a neighborhood exactly like we've said in the last 30 years we should be encouraging homeownership. And so all these people who are working a couple jobs as taxi drivers or house cleaners or, people who sell videos are trying to buy homes. And it was just breathtaking when I spent 3 or 4 days walking around the streets. There was one block that had 6 foreclosures within a block. So it's, you know, it's little brick houses, and this one is in foreclosure, and this one, you know, The article I wrote, I had number 732, number 747, number 760, number 720, number 1962, it was just like you were watching black wealth be sucked out of a neighborhood. And there's a lot of abandonment already. So, you know, houses that are in foreclosure, obviously you're not able to afford to, you know, to fix the shutters when they're broken. The neighborhood starts to look rough really quickly. And then there's actually homes that people appear to have walked away from. You know, some of them are classic absentee landlords, as happens in so many neighborhoods in New York. But a lot of them were owner-occupied, people who were just in way, way over their heads.
And were most of these owners who you spoke to victims of the kind of thing that Duane was just talking about, loans being kind of foisted on them that weren't appropriate for them, or was there relatively good faith on all sides? There has been a big push in this country for a few decades, and it's a good thing to get more low-income people into home ownership rather than having to throw money at the landlord every month. And I wonder whether these people you were speaking to felt that they had been, in effect, scammed out of their homes, or if it was more innocent than that.
People definitely felt that they had been scammed out of their homes. The idea to own your home has definitely taken root. You know, people have really swallowed and believed that that's a good thing, and it certainly seems to be a good thing. But how you go about doing it is the thing that matters. I spoke to another person who actually lives in Soundview, which is another neighborhood that has, you know, pretty high rates of foreclosure and subprime lending. He got a decent loan, a $300,000 loan. He was a mental health worker at a Bronx hospital, and it wasn't a terrible loan. It wasn't way more than he could afford. Like, he could afford his payments, but it had the 228, so it was fixed rate for 2 years and then adjustable. And he wasn't a stupid guy. He knew, you know, as the 2 years expired, he needed to refinance so that he could pay because he didn't want to deal with the adjustable rate. Mm-hmm. But it was like being in a loan shark situation. Every time he refinanced, he had to go through another broker who would always get him another 228, who would always get him further and deeper in debt. So he ended up, now he's in foreclosure and might lose his home, after paying for his $300,000 house on time every month for 4 years. He now owes $500,000 and is about to lose it.
Let's take a phone call. Steve in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's happening to you?
All right, I was under the impression that the banks had made some kind of agreement to work with us if we're in trouble. And I have to make a payment of 3 months' mortgage payments on the 15th. And I tried to make one payment or two, which I had in the bank, but they refused. They said it's all or nothing, and this is one of the larger banks.
Right.
So, you know, why are they not working with us?
That's what I'm hearing from NEDAP, which is the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project. I was just speaking to one of their workers this morning who said, you know, there's been a couple of these forums, and maybe this is where you met up with your lender to try to get a refinance to the caller. You know, where people have, some of our elected officials, I know in the Bronx, State Senator Klein, sponsored a forum where people could come and meet face-to-face with their lenders to try to get a loan modification. But not all of those were necessarily done in good faith. So in some cases, the lenders are saying, okay, here, you can refinance, but you're 3 months behind. You got to pay all your 3 months right now. It's like, well, if you were having a hard time paying last month and month before.
Where is this 3 months of mortgage payments coming from? Duane Jones, any advice for Steve?
Right. Well, there are two things. One, we know that the sheer volume of in contacts with banks, how overwhelming they are. Two, a lot of the times that frontline person that you're speaking with is fairly new and fairly untrained. They don't have a lot of loss mitigation capability up to the size of this problem. And in fact, you see them bringing in a lot of their collection staff. Even when they were out in the field here doing their outreaches, you saw more, the people that were really more professional about all this were actually their collection staff. Mm-hmm. And three, there's a different mentality when you're interfacing with the collection staff than if you've finally gotten over to the loss mitigation and you formally make an application into that process. for loss mitigation, and then you begin you're assigned a negotiator, you're assigned someone that's actually working your file and submitting it to determine what the guidelines are for that investor. A lot of times the servicer can only do what the investor permits him to do, meaning whoever actually owns that paper has rules and guidelines attached to that portfolio of loans that your specific loan is in. So when they're giving you options, they're basically just going from a matrix of what they can do based on guidelines. What we're seeing is the worse that the conditions get, the more there is flexibility, and particularly from the mainline banks, the banks that we know about. And they're even to the extent where one of the worst actors countrywide has started to move a little bit in that direction. But what we're finding there, they're a little bit sluggish, and I think a lot of that has to do with they were very aggressive in buying just the worst paper out there, and so they're servicing or they're investors in some of the worst paper out there, and with some of the worst guidelines.
On WNYC, we're talking about the foreclosure crisis in our area with Dwayne Jones, Director of Lending at the Parodnik Foundation, a nonprofit that does foreclosure intervention and default counseling. He was just speaking. And Eileen Markey, who's been writing about this for The Village Voice and the National Catholic Reporter. Steve in Morristown is on the line, who says he may be in foreclosure next week. Steve, you could stay there for a minute. And I also want to bring in Adam in Nassau County, who's a mortgage professional. Yes, Adam?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So what did you call to say?
Okay, well, I called to say that there's the problem, and I see it being one-sided, that the banks let down the purchaser or the person who refinanced or the mortgage professional was irresponsible. And I don't think that's entirely accurate. And I certainly don't think that it's everyone's responsibility to bail everybody out because of some poor decision-making or the fact that the market itself was depressed. You had someone on a few minutes ago that talked about this person who refinanced over and over into 228s, which is a mortgage product which is fixed for a two-year period of time.
I was going to ask you about that, getting deeper and deeper in debt. That was Dwayne who was talking about that. He's still on.
Okay. Well, I'm the one of the counseling professionals.
Right. Right. Actually, I was talking.
Oh, I mean, that was you. Sorry.
But it seems like a common thing.
And I'll say this with a few years of experience that I have with this, and specifically with that product, which for someone who was trying to purchase a home or was trying to refinance but couldn't qualify, the 228 product, which was offered by some of these subprime lenders, was a great instrument for someone to have credit extended with them, followed up with a little bit of responsibility on their part. The problem that's happened with that is the housing market as a whole. And the bigger picture with this is not the person who just keeps refinancing to pay off credit card debt and doesn't improve their credit.
You weren't refinancing to pay off credit card debt. I mean, obviously there are some irresponsible borrowers, but there are some people who, you know, paid their bills and honestly were trying and weren't buying a $1 million house they couldn't afford.
And I would add to that, as originators, and I've been an originator in the past, a loan originator in the past, but one of the responsibilities of an originator is to really help the person make prudent decisions about the mortgage debt against their home and their capacity to repay that. And a lot of that was people opted out of that prudency. You know, when, instead of someone really exploring budget and credit counseling, the people were mortgage broker houses were happy to get lists of people in credit card trouble and use that as a source of marketing them to get to debt consolidation loans to create these refinance situations that were just matches in the dry straw, because the first refinance to do the debt consolidation wasn't affordable, and every series of refinances after that, aided by sometimes the same loan originator, who would tell people to borrow to put cash away just to pay back the mortgage.
Adam, go ahead.
I'd like to interject, and please, I want to preface this by saying that I agree entirely. that, as within any industry where there's going to be commissions earned, it's going to attract some undesirable individuals, and that is a percentage of the problem. But I disagree in terms of someone even looking to market people with credit card debt, because the solution that that provides, you have someone who's struggling, who with their mortgage and their credit card debts, if they're able to roll that into the home, and lower their monthly payments by $1,000, $1,500. And at the same time, that debt is now paid and removed off their credit report, which improves their credit situation. And, of course, the counseling goes on the front end with this, and this is where the irresponsibility aspect of this occurred. But using equity to retire debt to improve your credit, to lower your monthly payments, and then ultimately get yourself into another loan, as a two-step process, is not a bad business decision if it's followed up responsibly.
Right, and if you take
I completely agree with you with that in concept. But when you put, like for instance, in New York City, when you put LIBORs into people and the number of 6-month LIBORs, or for instance, in the ARMs that went into New York City, 99% of the ARMs that went into to New York were
ARMs
six,
means adjustable rate mortgage. Go ahead.
This is a Federal Reserve study. These are like the 220s and the 327 ARMs, meaning that rate, that low rate that's going to help people handle their business, is going to only last for 2 or 3 years, and have a prepayment penalty if you try to get out of it before that. But we're talking about these 6-month rates, meaning that rate is going to adjust, and at the end of 6 months, at minimum of 2%, 99% of those ARMs were LIBORs, and so I go back to, yes, conceptually, that it was a great idea to help people manage their debt in a true budget and credit counseling sense, utilizing the equity.
And
this
remind
is
me
not,
again,
this is not what these products were used for by the people that abuse them in targeted communities. And when you see the masses of foreclosure for the same fundamental reasons, you can't say that this is the anomaly. This has been the rule and the practice.
And Eileen, in your Voice article, didn't you write that Williamsbridge in the Bronx has one of the highest rates of home ownership, 31% in the borough, and
it's a working-class Bronx neighborhood, black neighborhood with home ownership.
But what made my hair stand on end was that half of those mortgages were made through subprime lenders.
Right.
Let's talk to someone else trying to stave off foreclosure. Barbara in Bergen County. You're on WNYC. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay. What's your situation?
Well, I am scheduled for foreclosure at the end of May. I am trying very hard to find solutions, for example, selling my house in a short sale just so that I would avoid having the foreclosure on my credit, which is already, diminished at this point. But I have refinanced my mortgage quite a few times, and, I don't consider myself a careless consumer, and I definitely would not know what I was going against when the last time when I refinanced, my rate was capped for 2 years, so I knew that the rate would adjust after that. I was hoping to improve my situation, but what I wish in this whole situation is that the companies that offer mortgage would definitely not offer the opportunities to get a mortgage without income verification, because I think that, when people try to make ends meet and when they want something very badly, they will work and they will push themselves against, their odds and to the limits to make things work. But ultimately, it doesn't really, work out in the end. What I did is I tried to not budget my bills or food or whatnot, and just like kind of work with the mortgage payments. And it's sort of like when things got really worse financially, I was unemployed. At one time, I was working 3 jobs to try to pay the bills. And so I think in that situation, I would hope that the companies that offer the, getting mortgage without income verification would just not offer that. Because I think that if I was pushed and, if I was told, no, you definitely can't, we need all the proof, I was looking for opportunities to increase my freelance income and things like that. So, You know, and now it's sort
right,
of...
Right, it's a hopeful to buy a house, and it might not be quite realistic, but you're going to go into it with this, well, next year I'll make a little bit more money.
Right.
You know, there is obviously some responsibility there, but if the broker is and the mortgage lender are trying, you know, are making money off of that perhaps slightly unrealistic optimism, then you're going to get in trouble, and
yes,
you're going to lose their house, and they're going to get some money.
You know, and you constantly want to make things work, you know, so you're pushing yourself, well, maybe I'll, you know, get a better job, or maybe I'll get, you know, I sort of, you know, I've been working with this idea of foreclosure for the past 2 or 3 years, and this is the time that I really was served with papers, and I know a definite date. If the house doesn't sell, if it doesn't go through, then, you know, I will be foreclosed at the end of May.
And then what do you do?
Well, and then, you know, well, the bad thing in this whole situation is my credit is so bad already at this point that even getting an apartment anywhere where a credit check is being run, you know, I'm not going to be able to have, you know, a home. So I'm going to have to either rely on living with relatives or friends until I either can secure enough amount, you know, enough money to sort of pay up front for a year for a place to live.
We're already over time for this segment. But Duane, any quick words of advice for Barbara as she goes into that abyss?
Well, I would say that in your attempts at the short sale, the kind of the next triage option is the deed in lieu. And once you've documented the fact that you've made the attempts at the short sale, you know, you've got the multiple listings, you've attempted to get contracts in, you've brought contracts to the bank, whether they've accepted them or not, the process of actually having them, you have multiple listings now? You have a broker agreement now?
Yes, but actually my listing already expired earlier in the year, so
okay.
I didn't relist it.
Right, so those are the things that you need to take back to the bank and to the judge when you go back into court. And what you're really doing is you're really setting the case of, look, I made every good faith effort. Here you have the deed in lieu of foreclosure. Here are the keys. And essentially the bank takes the house. And you guys walk away, and you know it's not as healthy as a deed in lieu, but in as unhealthy a state as you are now, and in the path that you have to rebuild, you know it's really the next lesser evil.
Barbara, good luck, and Duane, just tell people how they can get in touch with the Porodnik Foundation, your nonprofit that does foreclosure intervention, if they need your help.
Right. Our number is 212-431. 9700.
431-9700 in the 212. And we've also placed a link on our webpage
at
WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to read Eileen Markey's articles on this in the National Catholic Reporter of February 22nd. And is it this week's Village Voice, Eileen?
No, it's actually February 26th.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
And can I just say one last thing?
Real quick.
The what's out there now is, like, the average mortgage that's outstanding right now is about $400,000 that's in delinquency. And that required about $80,000 in income, whatever the sources are. So I would just say that anybody that's out there in the housing market, no matter what your resources are, if you're trying to buy a home that's around $400,000 or above, you better be able to verify every single nickel of $80,000 for affordability. That means well out of the red line for what banks are already going to predict you're going to foreclose on.
Duane, thanks a lot. And Eileen, thanks again. We'll continue to talk about this, of course, many times. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, it's Follow-Up Friday.